By the way, thank you, Brian, for the very kind and pre-book launch review. Unfortunately, I won't have a chance to talk about the publication today. And thank you, Carol, for having me here after so much work. I'm going to present today in three parts. I mean, firstly, just a kind of imagery response to Carol's write-up in our section, really to draw on Brent Kuhlhaas's seminal book, Delirious New York, and to talk about the culture of congestion in Hong Kong terms. And I would say in Hong Kong, culture of congestion is alive and well, but in my opinion, Hong Kong is not delirious like New York. So I start with New York, really, the culture of congestion, I think as you all know, is based on the theory of the culture of congestion is based on the imagery and the operations of New York as a phenomenon. And really, Carol is, I'm repeating what Carol has said already many times, really the imagery of Hong Kong today is recalls very early visionary work by people like Fritz Lang, and even earlier from the first part of this century, of last century. And this is, for those that don't know the book, this is an image of the Downtown Athletic Club featured in the book, Delirious New York. That comes with the famous phrase, eating oysters on the end, if I can remember, eating oysters, boxers eating oysters on the nth floor. Yeah. But this building was featured in the book primarily as a commentary about how high-rise buildings can accommodate multiple programs. So this was really the beginning of the whole stacking theory, which is so evident in Hong Kong and many Asian cities today. And I was told by Graham the other day, walking down New York, that this has since been turned into a condo now. Not sure about that. Hong Kong also draws, the culture of congestion in Hong Kong also draws from de Bousier's vision. This was shown yesterday, the Plan Voisin. But then I would argue between this image and this image, much has been lost in translation. I mean, our architects from the 1950s and 60s basically went out and built these cruciform towers with infrastructure connecting, but there are many differences between this image and the Hong Kong image. One being that Corbusier's visions, even for the city of 3 million people, existed on a flat plane. The space between buildings was much more abundant, and the zoning and the land use planning was fundamentally different from Hong Kong. So I would say, although the images look similar, but there's actually a lot of difference between Corbusier's vision and what happened in Hong Kong. And this, as we move along, in the previous images were images of new towns, but this is sort of an inner city kind of classic shot of congested density in Hong Kong. And as Paul also introduced, the congestion exists at the street level as well. And this is an area in Hong Kong called Mong Kok, which used to, at one point, I think 10 to 15 years ago, had the highest density of land in the world. And I'm showing you this is because actually this is very close to the New York Athletic Club. Most of these buildings, we don't have a term for them in Hong Kong, but in Japan they call them a fashion building, and in Korea they call them multiplexes. Really shows you how very, very ordinary buildings can actually contribute to a very vibrant kind of metropolitan way of living by actually having stacked programs, mixed programs, layered upon each other. And I think one of the special characters of Hong Kong is that we've also got the horizontal layering of signs as well. So much so, we have this kind of overlapping, informal, congested imagery of Hong Kong that the successful retailer called GOD in Hong Kong has actually constructed this. This is actually not real, this is actually a collage of all the illegal, many, many illegal facades of Hong Kong, and actually turn this into a brand now, turn this into a product. So you can find this on handbags, t-shirts, whatever, pajamas, blankets. And really, I would offer actually, do people come to Hong Kong? I mean, the foreign visitors tend to come to Hong Kong to see this. Gradually, as we heard on day one, actually 60% of our tourists are from mainland China now, and like many international tourists, they come primarily for shopping, but also for this specific view. And I'd actually like to offer you today something of an alternative to this kind of view, which has got enough exposure already. Really, by presenting Hong Kong as a kind of dim sum city. This is a term that I coined up with some friends of mine. And I think really dim sum, it's very nice food, but it's something that is very common in Hong Kong. And I think this image really tells us a lot about how urban density and how real estate works in Hong Kong. I mean, for a start, dim sum is very delicious. It's prepared by very skilled chefs, and I think the people that make the buildings in Hong Kong are very skilled and they have good intentions. However, the people that sell the buildings, and I'm not talking about the developers, I'm talking about the real estate agents on the street, are very much like the character on the right-hand side who's actually a triad member. Very often at the launch of for those that haven't been to Hong Kong, the launch of these sales are when you drive up to the show flat, you get swamped by about 20 to 30 recently high school graduated real estate agents that shove brochures in your faces. So I think that's a kind of a very successful gangster tactic that has worked for many years in Hong Kong. But also the thing about dim sum is that the units are interchangeable, and that's the positive side I would like to share with you. And I really think that you know, I share Carol's sentiment that this kind of interchangeable, flexible stacking of units, however uniform they may look on the outside, is a good thing. And I would argue that we need more of this stacking, whether the buildings are 60 stories or 80 stories. And this stacking condition also occurs in another kind of very pivotal industry in Hong Kong, the logistics industry, that we have these sort of standard containers which are moved around by computers. Hong Kong, by the way, has the fastest turnaround rate of containers in the world, guaranteed 24 hours. So I'd like to move on to some speculations of other ways to define density. Because over the past 2 days, we've heard many definitions in terms of connectivity or in terms of statistics. But I would like to offer maybe a more qualitative view about what density means for Hong Kong people and for Hong Kong. First of all, really dealing with the image of the city, it's a saturated density, and this is a shot from the book Over Hong Kong of how density in 82 was already saturated, but it's getting more and more saturated on the Hong Kong Island side, primarily because the government has allowed reclamation to continue. And you can see the IFC building in the middle, being the main star. Hong Kong, this image again, which you can download from the Hong Kong Tourist Association's website with conditions, is a kind of branded density. You know, density has become a brand, so it's a kind of different brand from the GOD brand. But I would say that this is a spectacular light show that happens at 8 p.m. every night without fail for about, I think it's 20 minutes. So the image of Hong Kong, the skyline, the sort of elevational view of Hong Kong, this kind of elevational density was already there, but it's obviously not enough for tourists that come back, you know, again and again to shop. And so Our tourist association has come up with this brilliant idea of having a kind of light show every, laser show every night. And I'm not sure whether Norman Foster agreed to this, but the Hong Kong Bank building flashes between red, white, and blue, sort of every, like a disco light. We also have stacked density, and we've heard a lot about this over the past few days. I'm a real big supporter of stacked density and the transit that comes with that, and I think that's one good reason for us to have podiums. This kind of stacked density has really been in operation with transit integration really for the past for over 15 to 20 years. And I think the hypothesis of this really is the Kowloon Station project, which in a few years' time will have three major stations underneath it. But stacked density also means multiple programs as well. Paul just showed an image of the sort of urban footprint of Langham Place, which actually replaced the red light district. He forgot to tell you. That was the sort of primary red light district of Hong Kong, and so kind of a gentrification of the area. But I would argue that if you look inside Jodi's Towers, actually it's 13 stories of very, very mixed program, and it's actually a very skillful design. I think he borrowed a lot from casino design. Once you go in, you can't come out, you can't find the exit. And there's only escalators going up. When you come down, you have to walk. Basically, so I think that's it's incredibly skillful, and the mix of programs really, whether you like it or not, makes you want to stay there all day. There's also connected density, and these are sort of two views of how density is integrated horizontally, both in slow speed, sort of pedestrian on the left-hand side. The whole entire central business district of Hong Kong is connected not only by elevated walkways, but also underground connections. So you can actually theoretically hop from building to building in the whole. I don't know whether it's a square mile or not. I don't have the figures, but it's quite extensive through the whole entire business district without ever having to touch the ground. You can actually, and this is amazing, through most of the buildings in central. And this is something that's done by the landlords themselves, which has really worked to accelerate the already very fast speed of Hong Kong. And then on the right hand side we have the Tsing Yi project that was shown by MTRC the other day. Again, really an interchange. I think one of the successes of this kind of project is not only the fact that we have one form of transport below, but we have multiple forms of transit below these kind of podiums. And I think it's the interchange. It's not just having one form of transport going, but you can actually jump from, in some cases, especially in central, you can jump from tram to ferry to minibus to taxi to private car to pedestrian in one spot. And I think it's this interchange, it's the interchangeability of different transit modes, which actually makes Hong Kong very, very not dependent on public transport as being presented. And I'd like to show you that the map on the left-hand side is actually the all the connections in the central business district above and below ground. So it's really, really very well connected. We have these sort of elevated walkways, which are public, and they connect most of the buildings. There's another version of density, which is reclaimed density. So density can actually, in Hong Kong, miraculously can appear. This is, I would say, this is really the, apart from the new towns, it's the space of the waterfront, which actually has contributed to the increasing density of Hong Kong in the past 10 to 15 years. That's actually, on the left-hand side, is actually the reclamation and the infrastructure being put in on the Kowloon Station and West Kowloon Cultural District waterfront on the Kowloon side. And on the right-hand side, you can see the almost, this is an old picture, but the almost built-up mass on top. Density in Hong Kong can also be very generic. Control C and V, I think we all know, is copy and paste. And I would really, like to propose that us Hong Kongers being in New York, knowing New York, and comparing Hong Kong with New York now. I mean, I was up in the new museum today, and on the top balcony, and the other day in the Chase Manhattan Plaza, really looking over the urban landscape of New York, you don't get this sense of genericness. And I think no matter, we can't just look at New York and Hong Kong in terms of numbers, but also in terms of difference and qualitative difference. And I think that's really important. This is an image, by the way, standard, good quality public housing in Hong Kong. 50% of the population live in housing like this. And also, following from what Paul has been saying, I believe we have an evolved density, which is slowly disappearing, but there are crusaders out there. And this evolved density actually is the density that actually contributes to the community fabric of Hong Kong. It's very, very important. It's actually what what binds people together, and from a tourist point of view, is actually what a lot of the non-shoppers come to Hong Kong to see, much more so than Disneyland and the Buddha and Ocean Park. We also have an erased density. Density can be erased, and I'd like to offer an explanation of why Hong Kong is becoming more and more a city of amnesia. And I think Christine yesterday put her finger on it. It's because most of the buyers and decision makers in Hong Kong are, well, a lot, I wouldn't say most, but are first generation immigrants and in some cases refugees from other places. And as we know, first generation immigrants and refugees really have a very short term memory because they've actually left a place. My family also lived in a colonial house that was sold off and erased, like Christine. So, I'm also one of those that sigh. But I think that's much further in the past. But I think cases like Lee Tung Street. This is actually Lee Tung Street from above, which at one point was, if I got my figures right, was actually the main source of wedding card business in the world. They actually did global business of wedding cards in I don't know how many countries, but very, very good business, very characteristic. Apart from the, not to take away from your laundry shop and the abang who organizes weddings, but it's actually good business. It's actually something special in good business, and I really can't see why the Urban Renewal Authority has to target projects like this. And there's another very characteristic street which is about to be demolished, called Sneaker Street. It's the sort of sneaker capital of Asia. We also have Peter Cookson Smith yesterday mentioned the temple dimension, and Christine reminded us of people, and I think you can't have density if you don't have people. And I think it's very, very important. I think these two images, for me, are very meaningful because they represent a kind of freedom that we still have in Hong Kong. On the left-hand side, it's a Norman Foster's Hong Kong Bank building with escalators going up on the ground floor. It's a totally open ground. There's no lobby. You have to go through the escalators to get up to the first floor. And every Sunday, when our domestic helpers, the majority of them being Filipino, have their day off, they come here. They love to come to Central. Central is closed off, and this is one of the hot spots. They have picnics, they have karaoke, they have church meetings, all kinds of things that you can find, real public life. And I really appreciate this this space being open to the less privileged in Hong Kong on a Sunday. And on the right hand side, it really shows you that you don't need buildings in Hong Kong to have density. This is one of the sort of customary 1st of July marches that we have in Hong Kong. I think this was the year of SARS, this image here, when people take to the streets to, not necessarily to protest, but to really band together in a kind of a form of solidarity to say, well, this is what we think about the government. So back to the title, Designing Density. And I don't have any concrete answers, but I'd just like to pose three questions for you. In the coming years, when Hong Kong really is not growing anymore in terms of population, you've had almost zero population growth over the past 10 years. And actually, Hong Kong has the second lowest birth rate in the world. There's a very, very obscure island somewhere off Mauritius that has the lowest birth rate. We're the second lowest. So with this kind of zero population growth, do we really still need to increase our density? And how do we design future density? Should our future density be formal or informal or self-organizing, as Paul termed it? Should it be instant, as it was in the past with the new towns, or should it be should it happen in a more evolved manner? And should we continue to intensify our land, especially around the waterfront, or is there a growing culture now of de-densification? Well, it's up to the government. Just a few images about going back in history. Between the 60s and 90s, this is the kind of densification we got. From on the left-hand side, a kind of older neighborhood, and on the right-hand side, closer to the 1990s. Gradually now, after the year 2000, we're getting more developments in the new territories. And with improved sort of infrastructure links, especially to China, we're getting more developments in the new territories. Not all high rise. There is low rise in Hong Kong. And I'm actually waiting for the village housing laws to be changed in Hong Kong. Because right now, village housing, all the low rise here, you see a lot of it is village housing that belongs to the indigenous villagers that live there. They're only allowed to build in one form, so they're all 700 feet per level, and it's three levels, so they're all basically low-rise rectangular boxes. And looking forward beyond the current time, I think an even more important issue for considering Hong Kong density is what I call uni-densification, and it's the border between Hong Kong and Shenzhen and mainland China. Hong Kong is now part of China, but we are one country, two systems. And in the year 2046, this border, which is the, I don't have a pointer, but which is that river, the wavy line, will disappear. The political border will disappear. We will be one country, possibly one system. So I think it's very interesting to see that actually the mainland China side has been totally densified. Shenzhen has no more open land, and the Hong Kong side is still very, very green. And actually, Secretary Lam yesterday showed you that actually some of the new government plans, the new development areas in the chief executive's new policy speech, actually is focusing on this area. So I think this will be a great challenge actually, because this is the place where the two systems will meet, and right now it's black and white. So what will happen in the future? It's something I think is very important. And I'm going to show you, really, Paul has mentioned this project as well, but I'm going to show you two projects which I've, over the years, researched quite intensely, that I feel offer a way of really designing density in Hong Kong, but without designers. And one of them is the Kowloon Walled City, the other one is the mid-level escalator, which is in the exhibition in the Skyscraper Museum. Now, I show you these two projects. I'm very passionate about these two projects because both of these two projects didn't have architects. And even though I am an architect, I really believe that sometimes things could be better without architects. So if these two projects are so amazing, what are architects doing right and what are architects doing wrong nowadays? So you can see it's actually a historical project that goes back, I think it's the 1800s, and it's a no man's land. It was neither governed by Hong Kong inspired by the British Northern Chinese, and at its peak, I mean, it actually evolved from a salt mine to become really the densest place on the planet. And we have this amazing section of the top, which again was not done by Hong Kong, it was done by Japanese scholars. So I'm just going to run through very quickly. So, great community living there. It's a continuous roofscape. These are some of the drawings I did. And this is, again, a classic case of multiple program stacking. The right hand, the bottom right hand drawing there actually shows non-domestic units in operation, almost at all levels of the mass. And sadly, in 1992, I think it was demolished by the government. And paraphrasing Kuhlhaas, it was, I think it was a lobotomy of a dangerous ideology. It's too good to be true. So I don't agree that this is an infamous project at all. I'll just skip through that. And then, this is something that I researched for the Venice Biennale a couple of years ago. Again, a project without architects. It was done from engineering drawings and shop drawings from escalator supplier, manufacturer. And it's really a classic case of non-design architecture having an incredible value. It's actually become one of the top 10 tourist attractions in Hong Kong. It's kind of an accident, and really, really celebrates the cultural congestion in Hong Kong. It's 800 meters long in 20 sections. Open until midnight every day. I'd like to show you these because it's the linear side. You can understand it as the escalator goes up the hill, but it's really the sectional value. You know, the sectional value of Hong Kong, which is really, really amazing. Because when I actually did these drawings from site surveys, you actually discover that as the section of the escalator moves up the hill, it actually changes. There's never ever one section that actually repeats itself, and the diversity on both sides is really, really amazing. Programmatically, it changes throughout the day as well. This is a study done by some students of mine. And I'd like to end my talk with New York again. Started with New York. This is really one of my heroes. He's the inventor of the escalator. It's actually a person called Jesse Reno, who invented a 2.5-meter fun fair ride at Coney Island in 1895. And so we return really to Coney Island, the escalator now being a tourist attraction and not the the intellectual property of people like Schindler and Otis. Thank you.